Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Welcome back to another edition of Me and Eddie C. Sweeney Murdy, Ed Coleman, our weekly look at what's going on in the potential restart for baseball and some other things happening here. And Eddie, we're kind of getting to crunch time here. We've talked for the last few weeks about the potential plans back and forth. We know MLB and the union, they're negotiating, but we're at Memorial Day weekend here. And as soon as you get to June 1st, you're kind of hitting kind of a loose deadline. Nothing's been set as a hard deadline, but there's a pretty loose deadline. If you want to start playing baseball around July 1st or July 4th, you better start getting through the major parts of this deal and figure out if the owners and players can agree.
Yeah, no, I agree, Sweeney. You know, it's interesting because you probably need a two-week ramp-up period just to get ready for spring training, you know, for the clubs to get everything in order that they can, you know, go by the 67-page manifesto and have everything in line whenever that's formally approved by the MLBPA. But, you know, that doesn't give you a heck of a lot of time. That gives you probably till the end of the month, like you said, and then, you know, you need those 2 weeks or whatever to get everything together and go to spring training or have it in your home stadium. And they really haven't gotten around to the money issue at this point in time. We had the smoking email coming today, smoking gun, I should say, email, which probably doesn't bode well because it shows how far apart these two sides are and how entrenched they are at this point in time. I did see something from Austin Hedges, who's the player rep for the San Diego Padres, and he said that they were making progress, and he was optimistic. But that's probably the only player that I've heard say that at this point in time. I don't know whether there's a lot of optimism on both sides or some optimism, but you know, some of the rhetoric going back and forth doesn't really lead you to believe that it leads you to believe there's still a lot of animosity there.
Yeah, and there totally is. I mean, they're just drawing lines in the sand right now. The players have really no trust for what the owners are saying because they've never opened their books. And there's been this, you know, there's been decades of distrust built into this process. And without opening books, they're not just going to say, trust us, we're losing money, okay. And the owners are saying, you know, this is just the way the model is built right now. If we don't have fans, we are absolutely losing money, and it's right. going to cost less money if we don't play at all. So they're putting the players in position to choose whether or not they decide. They're the ones who are going to decide whether they get paid at all. And at this point, they want it to be on the owner's schedule.
Players are in a tough spot. You know, public sympathy has never been in their favor in any of these negotiations that have gone on for years. You go back to the stoppages that happened before in 81 and 94. It always seems like the fans, you know, favor the owners getting the game back on the field. It's never really been on the players' side. Players are taking the risks here. At the same time, you know, there are frontline workers, pharmacy workers, hospital workers that are putting their lives on the line for a lot less money than Major League Baseball players are going to make. And I think people, you know, that registers with people. And it's hard for the players to get empathy because of that. And I understand it. But, you know, when you ask for revenue sharing, it's interesting to me. There are so many things that can be hidden in baseball. You know, just take, for example, the recent sale, I guess it was, a couple of years ago anyway, when BAMTech, which was MLB, put that together, and they sold it to Disney. Well, the players didn't get anything out of that. The owners did, and the clubs did, but the players got nothing out of that. So that's kind of off to the side. You've got, you know, real estate around ballparks where they've developed restaurants and shops and clubs and stuff like that. You know, that's, that all helps the clubs as well.
And those are things that they will see zero revenue from if you're not allowing fans into the games.
So there are a lot of things that, you know, clubs are not municipally traded, let's put it that way. So, you know, there's a lot of things that they can, they don't have to reveal their profits, losses, revenue, et cetera. And that's a problem when it comes to revenue sharing, because the players are saying there's a lot more money there, but, you know, we don't know about it or we don't get it.
And I always found that odd because, you know, the games are played in stadiums that are built with at least some public money. So the fact that all this stuff is hidden from the public always seemed a bit off to me. When people say, you know, doesn't Congress have better things to do? You're talking about a multi-billion dollar industry, and every single game is played in a building that is at least partially publicly funded, if not a majority of it publicly funded. So I think it's always in government's absolute interest, and what they should be doing is looking into this because, you know, for all those reasons.
Yeah. And I, you know, something we were talking about just before we started, over the last 17 years, Major League Baseball revenues have gone up, and they've gone up considerably, as a matter of fact. And a lot of these clubs have great equity. I think I saw Scott Boras mention that somewhere in the realm of between $700 million and $2 billion in equity, all of these clubs have gone up over the, you know, the past several years. And yet, player salaries the last couple of years have gone down. And that will probably continue, I think, in the long run, because if the owners are going to lose money here, I think at one, you know, at some point in time, the player's going to pay for that, whether it be now or whether it be in the future. There's going to be some kind of, I guess, you know, conversion, let's put it that way, and something's going to flip around. So I think that's why the players, to me, are in a tough spot with this. And I hope that baseball can get back, and I hope that they can straighten these things out. But I don't think it's going to be an easy road here as we get to the end of the month.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we kind of talk about is where is the loss exactly? When you say that it's a $4 billion loss, is it a loss in revenue? Is it operating in the red? Is it a loss of profits? Where exactly is that? And that's why the opening of the books becomes an issue. Now, somebody I spoke to on the ownership side, that is absolutely operating on a loss, and that's spread out across all 30 teams. But as someone from the players' side said, that they are – what you're talking about, the growth in the business has helped the owners, yet the percentage of that has not trickled back to the players in the right proportions as far as the players are concerned. But now that losses are being taken on, the owners want the players to share in the equity of the loss, but not necessarily of the gains over these last several times. So, and I'm always fascinated. You mentioned this before. I'm fascinated, Eddie, at how most people seem to side with the owners over the players. And this goes back, you go back 25 years and the last big strike happened, the you know, everything blew up around 1994-95. You were still covering the Mets. I was producing shows with you, and we take call after call after call of people who are siding on the owners and calling the players greedy. And I never quite understood the, you know, it's the old siding with the billionaires over the millionaires. To me, it always kind of came back to this idea that people grew up playing baseball in their backyard. Right. They didn't grow up playing billionaire banker in their backyard. So it's always this idea that, well, that's something I did. Why are you being so greedy? But it's really not that simple. This is just something that's being played at the highest level, and their talents are not anything comparable to what you and I do in the backyard.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head. And also, I think that baseball, Sweeney, has always been, in most people's minds, the most accessible sport. You know, they watch football and they say, oh my God, these guys are, you know, they're huge, they're mammoth, they're slamming into each other. They watch basketball, 6'10", 7 foot guys running around. I can't do that. Yeah. They watch hockey. Well, I can't skate. I can't do that. Those are the main sports. They look at baseball. Well, you know, I've done that. Yeah. Well, I've taken a bat. No, you can't do it on their level, but right. you have done it. And I think that people approach it that way and they look at it and they say, well, you know, I'd do that and a drop of a hat for nothing, you know, and why don't these guys? And I think that's part of it too. But yeah, I feel for the players in this sense, because if the players don't take an additional cut now, which is what baseball wants in order to save them a little more money than what they're already going to lose, cutting their losses basically is what the owners are saying. Mm-hmm. But if they don't take the cuts now, you know, over the following years here, between, you know, either cutting payroll, clubs cutting payroll, pulling back in free agency and, you know, reducing the money there, or just, you know, not getting into free agency, or in the CBA negotiations, which will come up after the 2021 season, you know, they'll try to make it back there. In one way, shape, or form, I think the players are going to pay for it, unfortunately, and it's something that they're going to have to deal with here if they want to get back on the field this year.
I wonder if, listen, it's not ideal, and, you know, we make the joke about Bobby Bonilla every year, but I wonder if the simple answer is just some sort of deferral process, and that's what has to be negotiated for the players to get what they want.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's one way that they can kind of skirt around this a little bit. In other words, you know, give us the money that is here, and that's our half our salaries, whatever. If you can't give it all now, then yeah, we'll defer some of that. The percentage of what's deferred, I don't know. That you'd probably have to go back and forth on that. And the less that's deferred, I think the players would be happier. But at the same time, we'll see. But I think you're probably right. If there is a solution, that's probably the easiest way, or maybe the best way to get to it. I think that you may see that.
So if there is a game being played, the guidelines that were sent out last week that The Athletic got and a few other people got, that's been a topic of debate and discussion here. Lots of
different which ones do you like? Or which ones don't you like?
I like anything. Here's the thing. I heard one of the players say this, you know, it's not like you're going to get fined $100,000 if you spit on the ground. These are guidelines. And right. Listen, let's be honest. The players have voiced their opinions over the last several weeks that their safety is a very big issue. So right. The owners have set forth these sets of guidelines that say, okay, if you're concerned about health and safety, here's what we are proposing. And then on the other side of the player said, well, this is dumb. Okay, well, then don't do it or come up with something else. But if you're talking about ideas to address the safety, these are at least some things that you can do to mitigate the risk.
Yeah. Listen, everyone is going to have to sacrifice here. And honestly, you know, when I read through this at the end, I said, boy, that doesn't sound like a heck of a lot of fun.
Okay? Exactly. Right.
You know, it really doesn't. You know, but consider this. You know, you're not in a bubble type of atmosphere like you would be in Arizona or Florida, or, you know, if the original plans that they had. But at the same time, you're trying to cram, you know, listen, the NBA and the NHL basically play the kind of season that baseball is looking at, but they play over like 6 months, all right? You're doing this in 3 months.
Yeah.
You're cramming all these games in. If you're going on the road and you're going to hotels, and basically you can't leave that hotel to go anywhere, and even if you eat, you can't basically eat with your teammates. You have to eat apart from them. It's not a heck of a lot of fun. I see some inherent problems right away, even with the testing, you know, and I think they're going to be thorough. I think they're going to be stringent. But at the same time, you know, the two negative tests, if you do test positive, they won't shut down the game, supposedly. You're going to be quarantined for 14 days or two negative tests, if you can have that. But there's a lot of lag time between, you know, getting the test and testing the other people that you've contact traced with. You know, you're kind of all in the same boat. Everybody's they're going to isolate the people that have been close to you if you test positive. But if you're in a team atmosphere, everybody's close to you. You know, you're all together. So you have to test everybody. That's one part I don't get. And I think it's very it's a big obstacle to overcome.
And there are going to be people who have to police this to some degree. And it's, I don't know how uniform it's going to be. Maybe some teams take a little bit more seriously than others as far as how closely they're willing to police the separation of guys. And I'm just thinking this from, you know, from a perspective of families. We've already seen players talk about how it impacts their own families. Even if they're not going to shut everything down, if it becomes known that somebody on your particular team has tested positive, and maybe you're not necessarily in that close circle that they have to quarantine, how many players' wives are going to be calling up and saying, hey, get out of there now, or, like, you know, I don't want you to go back into that, even if you weren't necessarily part of that guy's circle. Somebody on your team got infected, you can't be there. You know, so there are so many other factors here that you can't control. And I think the home life is part of it. You know, I think people are going to have to deal with whatever nervousness their families have while they're going out there trying to earn their living.
Yeah. You know, I saw where the Korean Baseball Association or organization, KBO, if they have a positive test, they're going to shut it down for 3 weeks. Now, that's a much smaller league. I think they have 11 teams total. And they started earlier. They're already underway. They're playing at this point in time. And it almost seems to me that, that baseball is kind of saying, you know, if that happens here, if we have to shut down things, whatever, we'll never get through the season. We're going to have to shut it off. And we'll, and I think the owners are saying to themselves, we'll never get to the postseason. And if we don't get to the postseason, we're not going to make anything. We're going to suffer, you know, catastrophic losses. So I think that's, you know, what they're worried about at this point in time. I think there are a lot of ifs in this thing, and how this is going to work, I don't know. You hope it does. And I think they're trying to do the right thing. They're trying to cover as many things as they can and cover all the bases per se, but I don't know. There are still a lot of holes to me, and it's not just of their doing. It's just the virus itself and what it can mean and how it operates.
And I think you're going to create basically a class warfare in MLB, because there are going to be players, as we've discussed, who just decide that they don't want to go forward with the risk, and they are comfortable enough financially to make that decision. Where there are other players that can't afford to make that decision. So you're going to absolutely have some of the high paid players in this sport and the name players in this sport who are going to stay away from this because of all these different risk factors. And Eddie, we're just talking about what happens, you know, what if this a week into whatever spring training happens that players test positive. We're talking about, you know, trying to get games off the ground in July. What if you don't even get to July? What if you agree on everything and then things fall apart during your 2, 3, 4 week spring training? That's a whole other set of issues.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, we talked about trying to get things in order to get this in place so teams can ramp up the 2 weeks at the beginning of June for spring training. Then you've got another 2 weeks there you've got to get through, and all the testing and all the stuff being done, and then start the season. Yeah, with 3 months, July, August, September. I go along with baseball doing what they're doing, trying to get as many games as they can in through September and then play the postseason in October, and don't mess around and try to push it into November and December and start the next season late. I get what they're doing. I think there's an awful lot of stuff that you have to get through. You know, if it can start to move smoother and you can, you know, the coronavirus winds down, well, maybe so. Maybe things will work. But you worry about that with so many people, you know, coming out at this point in time, everybody getting back together and social distancing maybe being relaxed a little bit because, you know, people are a little more confident.
When the guidelines came out and you started hearing players saying, well, this doesn't make sense or that doesn't make sense, I thought back to a scene from A League of Their Own when the girls have all been picked for their teams and they're sitting on the field and the owner says, the commissioner says, David Strathairn, and he says, here's the uniform you'll be wearing. And they parade the girl on top of the dugout wearing the skirt. And everyone starts griping, like, I can't play in that. I can't wear that. I'm not going to do that. And they said, listen, if you can't play in this, you can't play for us. And that's basically where the players are, you know, if you can't play the game this way, okay, this is the only game there right now. And again, it's loose guidelines, but it's guidelines for everybody's safety. And if you're not going to adhere to them, you're putting everybody else at risk.
Yeah, you are. And it's, I think it's going to be very tough and tougher for some players who are more ingrained in the habits that they have. Let's put it that way. And baseball players, they're routine. It's all routine. It's all habits. It's all that stuff. And you know, I think we touched upon a little bit the last time, you know, chewing tobacco, gum, sitting next to each other, or next to each other on the rails, watching the game, yeah. Talking about the game. There's so many things. I love the. How about the showers? Okay, we're not taking showers at the ballpark. Just climb on the bus and go back to the hotel and shower. I don't know how that's all going to work. Being in the weight room and being apart from people or not being in the weight room. How about just the fact, you know, how guys are so ingrained about going in the cage, even during games. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked about before about the possibility that, you know, with all the scandals that have happened in baseball, that you wouldn't have access to going back and watching at bats on the camera. But, you know, the hitting cages have always been open for guys to work on things. And now you don't go in the hitting cage. So those are all adjustments that I think going to be very hard for a lot of players.
I was thinking about the idea of trying to watch games without fans. And one of the things that people saw as a potential positive was the ability to hear the chatter during the course of a game. You know, you hear the managers and the coaches yelling at the umpire. You hear the players talking to each other. But one of the other things I just thought of, if you're doing the proper distancing in the dugout, you know, the players talking to themselves during the game disappears, talking with each other during the game. You know, you're watching a pitcher and the hitters are comparing notes with each other. If you're all sitting 6 feet apart, that becomes a lot harder to do.
Very true. Pass notes. But then again, you'd have to watch about the passing the notes. Yeah. Wash your hands every time. Listen, I understand it as well because I saw the video. I don't know if you saw the video about the tennis balls this week, about changing tennis balls during a match. But I mean, that's what's going to happen. If a couple of guys, you know, on a ground ball that's thrown over to first, you're going to throw that ball out of play. Okay. Because a couple of people have touched it, bring in another ball.
You can't throw it around the infield after a strikeout, can you?
Exactly. No, can't do that either. Too many people touching it. So it's bizarre. It's hard. I think it's, like I said, there are going to be a lot of adjustments and a lot of things to get through. And I think until you actually do it, you don't know how difficult this may be. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned it kind of joking about it, but I think it's a real thing. You know, you said like you read through everything and it's like, wow, this doesn't sound like any fun. Again, kind of like how the fans feel about players and not sympathizing with them. I'm not expecting anybody to sympathize with us. But I thought about this week. Our jobs are a lot less fun because I don't even know if we're going to be allowed to go to the games. We're going to be watching the games. I think a lot of what we do is going to be done remote, especially road games.
Certainly road games. Yeah.
But you know, I've always thought that we have the best jobs at our radio station. You know, the people who work at our station, who do the shows, you know, they get paid a lot more money than us, but they sit in a studio and they talk. They will go home, watch the games on TV. Sometimes they go to the park, but their access, you know, we're the ones who have access to the players and we talk with the players about the game. We have fun with the relationships we have there. And we have a different experience than the other people at our radio station. And I'm just thinking, you know, from a purely selfish standpoint, our jobs are becoming a lot less fun when you take us away from the direct experience we have there.
Yeah, I mean, that's all gone. There's no contact. We were talking about, you know, what happens after a game now, home or away, it doesn't matter. You will have somebody brought into a room and you will have some kind of feed where I guess reporters, broadcasters will ask questions of that person. And, you know, for a limited amount of time, couple of minutes, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. You won't have the sessions that you had with, Aaron Boone and Luis Rojas this year and, Terry Collins in past years. And, you won't have those things going on. You won't be in locker rooms talking before or after games, for that matter. So, and you'll be watching off monitors. It's a lot different. There's no question about that. It's a lot less fun, I think, on this end. But I think on the players' end, too, I think it's going to be tough. I know that everybody wants to get back and play, but I think it's going to be a little less fun for them as well, too.
And I think even just to be able to relate this to a fan who probably can't sympathize with what we're saying, what you and I do, what all reporters do, is based off the relationships that you build with these guys. And everything we know about the game and how we express that on a daily basis on the radio is basically built off of the relationships we've built with these sure. guys and how we are able to see it through their eyes because we've been able to talk to them about it. And that yeah. there's a you throw a wall up there, there's a big disconnect there, and it really just takes away from what we're able to offer fans from out because we don't have the same access that we used to.
Yeah. I mean, probably listen, we ask a lot of questions over time, but when you're talking to a player and trying to get inside his head and what's going on, basically you're saying, hey, what were you thinking there? On this play, on this pitch, what were you thinking there? And that's how you learn about how yeah. they approach the game and what they're thinking and what the mindset is, et cetera.
Tell and me you might be, I don't know.
Yeah, you might be talking to a manager or, what were your thoughts there? I didn't, I understand what you were doing, but why did you do that? And, mm-hmm. Those things are gone because you have less time to do that, obviously. Right. And you're more sheltered now. You're more apart. It's more distant. So I think you lose a lot of that. Yeah, on both sides.
I hope I expressed that a little better than Blake Snell expressed his thoughts. Did that come across better to you, Ed, or am I going to be in the firing line here now?
Yeah, God bless Blake Snell. Huh? I mean, listen, I just winced when I read that and heard that. I did understand what he was saying.
He had valid points. He just expressed yes. them very, very poorly.
Yeah, very. It was terrible. You don't want to come across like that, and that's exactly why he's probably a poster child for why there isn't a lot of sympathy or empathy for Major League Baseball players. Blake Snell just he kind of blew it in that sense, and several guys came out. I think Bryce Harper and a couple of others came out as well and said, hey, listen, he's right in what he's saying. I probably wouldn't say it that way, but I think that's the problem that you have. You've got to couch things the right way at this point in time and deliver your points in a better style, let's put it that way, than Blake did, to say the least.
All right, so you and I've finished like everybody else. We finished watching The Last Dance, and a couple of takeaways from the end. I actually, I thought the last two episodes were like the weakest of the whole bunch. I didn't think it wrapped up very well
right.
for me.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Black Jesus is here. We did get that toward the end of the last couple of episodes. Yeah, with Reggie.
The two quick things at the end. It finally took Scottie Pippen until like the last 20 minutes of these 10 hours to tell us that Jerry Krause was the guy yes. who deserves credit for this. And even Jordan, with all of the contributions he made to this, didn't allow even one bit of that towards the end.
Yeah, and I noticed, I think it was in the last episode, right toward the end, too, when Jerry Krause's name came up, he kind of, smirked or whatever. Mm-hmm. That. So it was a final dig at Jerry. A lot of props to Pippen for that. And Pippen, he had some bad moments in this. There's no question, yeah. Sitting out, choosing to sit out there. But in game six there, the final game when they won the sixth championship, he came out pretty good with the sword back and mm-hmm. playing in that. He looked awful up and down the court, but he came out. I give him a lot of props for giving credit to Jerry Krause. You're right. And he came up big there toward the end for sure.
I think a couple of things that Michael underestimates when he talks about the idea of coming back for a run to the seventh championship. Everybody taking 1-year deals to come back. Scottie Pippen mm-hmm. has been playing on this undervalued deal for the last 7 years. He's right. not going to just take another $2 or $3 million to play for one more title. He's finally got a chance to sign for more money than he's made in his entire career to this point. He's probably going to do that. So one, Jordan doesn't have the number two player that has helped him get to six championships. The other thing I think is that, you know, another year older and the rest of the cast, I don't know about you, but remember, the Knicks never got to play Jordan's Bulls with Latrell Sprewell guarding Jordan. And I thought with a defender like that on Jordan, that might have made a big difference if it came down to Knicks Bulls. Assuming Allen Houston's shot goes in again in game five against the Heat, and there's some, you know, I don't know, the Bulls are not the same team, but the Knicks are not either. I don't know that they could have run through the East the same way.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. It was nice to hear him say that. You know, everybody would have come back for seven. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It was also kind of interesting to hear him say, you know, I can't accept that. You know, it's still something that eats at him after all these years that he didn't get a chance to go back and win another one, seven. But you know what? You're right. It wouldn't have been the same cast and the same crew, you know, for him to go with it. So I don't think it would have mattered at that point in time. You know, there were a couple of things that struck me during watching this, just watching the scores of the games. Yeah. You know, like, we're 20 years on from that, okay? This league is entirely different now. Yeah. They were playing 76-73, 88-85. It was amazing. And one thing, I got the biggest kick out of this, that when Reggie hit the game winner in game four, and they showed it from several angles, but the push.
Oh, good one. Michael Good shiv right there, wasn't it?
I mean, that's going the other way in this day and age in the NBA. He gave him a shiv that knocked him about 15 feet, for that matter, to get him out of there. And nothing. No call. No whistle. It was tremendous. But I said, you're never going to see that in the NBA these days. I got the biggest kick out of that.
I'm surprised. The one thing, unless I missed this, there was a part of the Brian Russell story that they kind of shoved to the side.
Yeah.
I read something about Brian Russell too that made me laugh. But, you know, he's the guy that defended on that last shot and was part of Utah's team the last 2 years. There was an exchange that I vividly remember because I think the story was that Brian Russell was going to defend Michael Jordan. And Jordan, in talking about him, you know, because Brian is spelled Bryon, he kind of misspoke and you know, confused it. He says, is it Brian or Byron? And people took that as a slight towards Russell because somebody of Jordan's intelligence obviously knows the guy's name, but he kind of made it playful. And they went back to Russell about it. And Russell said, Russell's comeback was, is it Michael or Michelle? And everybody was going, oh my God, don't do that. Don't do that. And everything we know now about Jordan, that's all I needed. But that part was left out. I vividly remember this exchange between these guys in press conferences during the NBA Finals.
Yeah, that's amazing. What was Russell's line? I think that they left in the why you quit. Why you quit?
So he stored that in his memory bank.
Yeah, I got a kick out of and again, it speaks to his competitiveness. But when you think about it, Charles Barkley was the MVP of the league when they faced the Suns in the finals, and that's all Michael needed.
Yeah.
Oh, he's the MVP. Yeah. Oh, okay. And then Karl Malone was the MVP the year, not the last year, but 97. In 97. And Karl Malone's the MVP. Oh yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for reminding me. Okay. Bingo. There's another championship.
Maybe that's a reason why they should not announce the MVP during the finals.
Hold that for later.
I read about Russell is that Brian Russell seriously believes that the Utah Jazz should retire his uniform number. And there was Stockton and Malone, and the quotes I read about from the other guys, like, they're being diplomatic about it, but you know, come on, you were not, those other guys are the top 50 players of all time.
Yeah.
You know, you were a part of the ride for two teams that made it to the finals. It's not like you helped win championships, bro. You got to bring it back down a little bit.
I don't see, like, Jordan, Pippen, and Ron Harper. Okay, that's it. Yeah, yeah. That's not, exactly. It's like you got Malone, Stockton, and Byron Russell. Yeah, that's not good. And you know, one thing that which it really affected me to hear him and listen. He's an eloquent speaker. I think we know that. But Steve Kerr and the story about his dad when his dad was shot at the University of Beirut, and then he hits the game winner in game six. But I've always liked Kerr. He's always spoken his mind, and he speaks very eloquently. And he has an edge to him, that's for sure. I think we've seen that as the Golden State coach. But I thought he came out very well in that, and it was nice to see that part. I thought he framed it pretty well.
The thing that I liked watching, just watching back the whole thing, I remember Jordan's greatness. I mean, I was a fan from North Carolina. I remember staying up late. I was almost 12 when he hits the game-winning shot against Georgetown. So, I mean, I was made into a Michael Jordan fan at just the right age for his greatness. I remember the greatness. The thing I didn't remember quite so well is the ferocity. And I mean, obviously you knew the hunger and the desire to win, to compete and win championships, but just the ferocity with which he played the game, that's something that I'd kind of forgotten.
Yeah, no, a very good point. I think the other thing that always that struck me, I think, in watching this over the span of 5 weeks is, and I've always believed this about great players, the elite of great players, let's put it that way, that they probably practice harder than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And again, I think Jordan, manifested that. And you saw that time and time again, even in when they were at the Olympics, which is probably downtime when you're playing with your teammates and it's kind of a pickup game. There was never a pickup game for Michael Jordan. He wanted to win everything, every time, anyway, even playing cards. And that's, on the golf course, all that stuff. But how competitive he was. But if you're you play like you practice. A lot of people say that. And boy, did he ever practice. He practiced hard, and he played with that ferocity then, and that's why it showed so much on the court, too.
As we're trying to figure out how to get the rest of the events back on the sports calendar, we're in late May, so we've already missed the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness. The Belmont should be coming up in a couple of weeks, and horse racing's actually been opened up.
Yeah.
You were telling me about something with the Belmont that's a little twist on the Triple Crown this year.
Yeah, they're going to reduce. It's usually a mile and a half. It's going to be June 20th, so it's not that far away, really. It's about a month away. And normally it's usually Derby first Saturday in May, Preakness, I think it's a couple of weeks later, and then the Belmont 3 weeks after that, so like early June. But this is June 20th. It's going to be the first leg, and it's like a mile and a half normally, but it's going to be a mile and an eighth because they have to adjust for the three-year-olds and where they are in training and that. But what's kind of weird is usually you have it done in a month, Derby, Preakness, Belmont. This is going to be 5 months because the Derby is September 5th, and then in October you have the Preakness, like the beginning of October. So it's going to be like 5 months. I don't know. You're going to have to put an asterisk next to it, but it's going to be
Triple Crown happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's just going to be weird to see the Belmont first, Derby in the middle, and then the Preakness at the end. It'll just be weird this year. But then everything is weird this year, Sweeney. So what the heck?
We should be at ballparks. Memorial Day weekend is coming up. I mean, you hardly remember that it's Memorial Day weekend. Because you're thinking about kickoff to summer, you're thinking about the warm weather is finally coming, and you're about 2 months into the baseball season, and you really just kind of hit the ground running with that. But Memorial Day weekend, obviously, the baseball always goes to great lengths to show why you should be celebrating and remembering that. And you were telling me about an article in the Boston Globe from Teresa Hanifin, a column that illustrates a different point there.
Yeah, Teresa is she's a terrific writer. She's been at the Globe for years, and she said something the other day. Wrote something the other day that really struck me. And I think it stemmed from possibly the lack of empathy, which seems to be emanating from the White House these days, but just about, I was struck the other day when you just watched the death totals rise. And by Memorial Day, we should be 100,000 people dead in this country by this, disease, which boggles my mind. And she was saying, Memorial Day is something that we always honor the veterans for, and we should. But she said, this year, maybe if we do something a little bit different, I'll just read just a little bit of what she wrote. Said, I think if we don't know somebody who has died from this horrible disease, we're kind of complacent about the mounting toll of dead and dying and how rapidly we have lost so many fellow Americans. Maybe if we stopped and really thought about it, tried to grasp the full measure of what is happening, it would be too emotionally overwhelming. She suggested maybe the flags at half staff, on Monday, just to remember the people who have died. Not to forget about the veterans, but she said the blue collar workers who have kept our food and supplies moving, who have died, the veterans who have died in soldiers' homes and nursing homes, the ordinary people who have suffered and died. These are the people we should remember this year. I just thought it was a great point. And I think it's something that we should keep in mind come Monday, along with the veterans.
It kind of underscores a point that I've thought about recently is that, and she mentioned it right there. If you don't know somebody who's been affected by this, or if you're not in the heart of it, kind of like we are close to New York and the New York suburbs that have been hit pretty hard, upstate, other states, it's almost like a TV show because they haven't experienced it firsthand the way we have here. And it makes it harder to understand all the things that have been happening because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely true. Absolutely true. I just thought it was a very good point. Teresa brought it up the other day in something she wrote, and I think it's something we should think about on Memorial Day. I don't know if you were a Fred Willard fan, but Fred Willard passed away, 86 years old. Great comic, Martin Mull show from years past. Modern Family, obviously. And that's where probably most people know him. But Jimmy Kimmel, if people want to look back and maybe looked this up the other night, did like a half an hour tribute to Fred Willard, who was on his show a lot. And one of those guys that everybody loved.
Generational, really.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, he cut through generations, and just a very funny guy and very, very amenable to anything you wanted to do with him. Always, he was often the butt of jokes, but he didn't mind at all. He played that to a hilt. It was a nice piece done by Jimmy. So if people are Fred Willard fans, maybe they can look that up and check it out. It was pretty good.
Absolutely. And I guarantee you there are so many things you're like, oh, I forgot he was in this. Oh, I forgot was in that.
Exactly.
And funny in every single one of them. The great Fred Willard. We've got some replays coming up. And I should mention to people that the classic replays are going to be coming to an end soon on our radio station. And it's going to lead to more shows, which means you and I are going to be on a little bit more often. I know the FAN announced a more regular weekday lineup, but I think we're going to be part of the weekend lineup starting in June. The dates are still to be determined, but instead of just talking like this to ourselves for 30 or 60 minutes every week, we will have a couple of opportunities to put some real shows together on the air. So we'll let people know when that's happening. But the replay is coming up. The Mets run to the 2015 pennant continues with Mets Cubs games 2 and 3. The Daniel Murphy Show rolls on.
It's exactly right. You put it, you hit it right on the head. Murph, game 2 and 3, they're going to play of the Cubs series. They won game one. They swept the series. So one game one, obviously. Game two was more of Murph. Actually, in the first inning, I think it was a Grandy single, a right RBI double, and then a Murphy home run. And all of a sudden, it was 3-0 off Jake Arrieta. Syndergaard pitched great. I think he went into the sixth. They got another run later. They won easily in that game. And then more Murph in game three. Now, what's a game at that point? He actually, I think, when he homered in game three, and I believe that was the sixth home run and fifth straight game that he homered in, because he homered in the last two of the Dodgers series, and then the three in the Cubs series as well. Bartolo Colon, who wants to make a comeback and retire as a Met, started that game and got the win in game three. And DeGrom, Bartolo pitched game four. That was it. Bartolo was game four. DeGrom pitched game three. Pitched great, 1-7. Gave up a run early and three hits, and all of a sudden, did what Jake does, bear down and get through it. But those won those games. They were up 3-0, and then Bartolo came on and they won game four.
So I went back and looked up and forgot what a really good postseason Curtis Granderson had. Had a couple of really big hits, and then he hit three homers in the series. Phenomenal postseason for Granderson.
Grandy had a great postseason. And again, Jurys Familia continued. And again, Familia, it's funny because he has this place in Met fans' minds because of what happened in the World Series. And it did not go well for him. But he was great in the Dodger series and again in the Cubs series. He saved the first three games of that series and was terrific. He'd mowed people down. It just it didn't last into the World Series, unfortunately. But that's the way it goes. That's the way the game goes sometimes.
You know, it's funny. When we think about players, back to Granderson for a second, we think about players who've had success both the as a Yankee and as a Met. We talk about Daryl Strawberry and Doc Gooden because they won rings with both teams. But you know, Curtis Granderson had four consecutive years with the Yankees, then followed it with four consecutive years with the Mets. He is actually, I believe I looked this up, I don't know, a few months ago. Mm-hmm. He has more home runs of any New York player in the last decade.
Interesting.
Because he, you know, he was in the city.
Sure, yeah.
Not just Yankees or Met. But he had four really good years for both teams and racked up home runs, more homers by any New York player in the last decade. And he recently retired anyway before all of this. But, you know, I don't want to say great player. I don't want to say he was underappreciated. I think we all kind of understood who he was and what he was. But just a really good player and survived and thrived for both teams.
He was a guy that I would put in like my very good class, you know, not a Hall of Famer, but a guy who did it for a long period of time and was pretty consistent during that time as well. And you kind of knew what you would get from Curtis Granderson. And you also got leadership, too. I'm not trying to push Tony Clark out of a job, but I always pictured Curtis Granderson as, say, maybe the head of the Major League Baseball Players Association. You know, if he wanted to do that, I always thought that might be a good niche or place for him. But like I said, Tony's got it, so I'm not trying to push Tony out of the way. Especially not now.
I don't think
Curtis wants it right now either. I don't know if anybody does.
That's a good point. The Yankees replays this week are games 3 and 4 of the division series in 2017 against the Indians. The Yankees had fallen behind, losing the first two games in Cleveland. Girardi's blunder on not challenging in game two. Helped drop them into that two games on the deficit. The Yankees came home. I do remember, Ed, coming home from Cleveland after game two and just how quiet Joe Girardi was. And, you know, everybody was kind of quiet just because they're down two games to them, but Girardi especially so because, you know, he knew in the aftermath of that game right away that as much as he tried to spin what was going on, not challenging that particular play and call really was something that ate at him. And I remember getting on the bus in Cleveland, getting off the bus in New York and picking up the bags at 2-3 in the morning, whatever it was, and just saw how much it hurt him to put his team in that position. The team responded by winning games 3 and 4 and obviously eventually game 5. This week you're going to hear games 3 and 4. Masahiro Tanaka was 7 scoreless. That's the game where Greg Bird had his big moment. Left home run against Andrew Miller. In a 1-0 victory in Game 3. Game 4, Luis Severino went 7 strong. He gave up 3 runs. Tommy Kahnle finished up with 2 scoreless because Dellin Betances, this was the last big spot the Yankees put Betances in that postseason. They tried to get him through with a 4-run cushion. He walked the first two batters. They got him out, and Dellin's struggles continue. You have not gotten a chance to see Dellin yet in a Mets uniform. I know
he
was looking forward to playing in a Mets uniform, and I'm a big fan of Dellin. Really, you know, I don't even know how to put it, just total dominance for about 4 solid seasons and really most of 5 with a little blip in between as he tries to figure himself out. But I think he got himself back in the right direction, and I think he was ready to have a really good season for the Mets if things, you know, got off to a normal start.
Yeah, I didn't get to see him at his best because he was kind of working his way up, kind of ratcheting his way up and back from the shoulder and the Achilles, although the Achilles wasn't much of a problem. He said it was more the shoulder. And, you know, he was only throwing high 80s and maybe 90, 91 or something when I saw him down in spring training. So I'm sure it's better. I'm sure it's a lot better now, and I'm looking forward to seeing him when he gets back. You know, the Girardi thing you mentioned, I always felt for Joe in that sense because head and heart, you know, and I always thought this way about Joe's thing, kind of like what Terry Collins went through with Matt Harvey in Game 5 of the World Series. You know, Terry had said, had told us before the game that the plan was, you know, 7 or 8 out of Harvey if he could, and turn the ball over to Familia, and then on to Kansas City for Games 6 and 7. And that changed, obviously. Mm-hmm. And he went with his heart. I think it's something that, you know, Terry, listen, you have to do what you think is right at the moment. And I think he did. But I think if he thought back upon it, you know, he would have changed his mind and would have done it differently. And probably Joe, too. But I always thought about Joe in that sense when I always thought about Terry in that sense when Joe was going through what he went through in 2017.
Those are the replays on the radio this week. I actually watched part of, I guess it was Game 2 of the 86 World Series on SNY last night. And it's funny, I had kind of really forgotten part of the big storyline was the Mets didn't hit at all in the postseason. You know, they won the Astros series despite getting shut down. And you just keep thinking Mike Scott, but you forget that overall they didn't hit. And that point was illustrated. And they lost the first game of the World Series, 1-0. So they're heading into Game 2 facing Roger Clemens and saying, you know, where is this Mets offense? And obviously, you know, we kind of know how it ended. But I had forgotten that whole point that they had gotten through the first now 7 games of that postseason with almost zero offense.
Yeah, I think it was, well, it was Game 3, I think, when they faced Oil Can Boyd. And I think Dykstra got him right off the bat. And that kind of, that was like Jeter's home run against the Mets.
Right.
This one's over. But they were back with that. And they had an offensive outburst in Games 3 and 4, for that matter. So, and then it worked out. I was a Red Sox fan at that time. I was still living in Boston at that point in time. But that was a great series, tremendous series.
You mentioned Jeter, and I forgot to mention this. I stuck in my head the other day when people started throwing these the pizza conspiracies out there again.
Oh, yeah.
Jordan's pizza experience in Utah. And I remember Jeter telling me, you know, he got a bad pizza in Boston once, but they didn't try to poison him. He and Posada went out for pizza, and when they brought it to their table, the guys had spelled Pedro in pepperoni on his pizza.
That's great.
But it tasted fine. He was fine. He didn't get food poisoning off of it. But that was the response.
Pedro and pepperoni. I love that. That's great.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. Well, as I said, people will be able to hear us a little bit more regularly. I think starting in June, you and I will be having some shows on FAN. And it might mean the end of this little weekly gathering. We'll see how that goes. But it's fun. You and I get to see each other as we do this on FaceTime. Hopefully fans enjoy hearing us and getting our thoughts on, you know, whatever state of baseball it's in right now. And as we try to get going something close to back to normal. Eddie, go get yourself a haircut. Looks like you have a couple growing out on top there that
need
to get trimmed.
I need a trim in the worst way, that's for sure. Yeah, I'll get myself spruced up. Thanks, Winnie.
All right, we'll talk soon, and everybody stay safe, and thanks for listening.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.